Welcome to Functional Design Enclosure. I'm Christoph Newman.
And I am Nate Jones.
We're here to help you use closure and functional programming together to make your everyday life as a developer less frustrating and more fulfilling.
Yes, absolutely. Welcome to the show. If you're new here, we're on episode 113 now, so there's a way back at the beginning. Go back to number one and figure and find out where we started. And hopefully you'll enjoy the journey. This is the last episode of our current series, the Sportify series. We're on episode 113. So if you want to start that off at the beginning, go back to 101. And in Sportify, what's our mission, Christoph?
Sportify. Our mission is to flood social media with sports highlights because, you know, you just can't have too many of them, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Sports everywhere.
Yes. I'd much rather get all the highlights. So I think since this is our last episode of the series, let's do a little highlight reel looking back on the journey, shall we?
Yes, yes. Let's have a highlight reel of our highlight reel making process. Yes, it has been a journey for sure. And so we started this whole crazy journey when Alice the intern left. And she had been making periodic highlight videos every now and again by hand because, I mean, you got to have something for the intern to do. But she went back to school to continue her media arts degree. And so we said, well, let's automate this because, you know, we're programmers and closure and why not? And so we fired up our REPL and we fiddled around in our REPL and started to figure out all the little parts one by one. And that worked our way towards a tracer bullet where we had this imperative decomposition, right? Just sort of these imperative steps one after the other that automated the process end to end.
And then we were done. Oh, no. Of course we weren't done. Then we started having errors. Errors.
Yes, we just keep getting done over and over again. Oh, and now I'm done. Oh, wait. And now I'm done. Oh, no. Oh, wait. Okay, but now I'm done.
Yes. Yes. So as we need to do as developers, lots of times we're trying to debug. So we figured out how to separate the IO from the pure parts of the code, and then those pure parts, which are all the decision bits, which is the important stuff, that was it enabled us to make that a lot more testable. And so we found that as we pulled those apart, we got this. It ended up more and more information, more and more working context, working information about, you know, what event we're working on, what clips we need to work on, what we need to put together for the final highlight reel. We got all those little bits of information. And then we thought, well, wait a second, let's put it all together into one context. One thing, one context to rule them all, you know?
Right.
And in the darkness bind them.
Right. In the darkness. We're trying to spread the light of sports highlights across
in
the
lightness bind them.
And well, the practical issues, we wanted to know what everything was when it went wrong, and getting all that information together and in a pure data sort of way let us do that. And then as we were continuing to work on this, we realized, man, there's a lot of repetition in here between these steps, and we saw an emergent structure. And the next thing you know, it sort of emerged this think, do, assimilate loop that turned out to be something that looked an awful lot like a general solution for keeping IO at the edges and pure data at the center of everything that we were doing.
Yes. Well, we kind of want to take some time. We're going to take some time to reflect back on the highlights, the learnings that we've gotten from this series. It's this nice long series. I think it's our longest series ever, which is kind of cool. So, Christoph, what comes to mind? What would you like to start off with?
Yeah, there's certainly a lot of points we made. And so I guess in this highlight reel of the series, the biggest thing that sticks out to me is the idea of working with situated problems. You are in the middle of a real world scenario. Some problems are more toy problems. Some problems are very pure. You know, they're like mathematically constructed. They're axiomatic. They're the nature of the problem itself. You know, you have a game board. that game board that is a synthetic thing, right? We invented tic-tac-toe. It's all synthetic, right? The board is of our design. The rules is of our design. Everything can be known. But in this other category of problems that we've worked a lot in, they're situated. The real world dictates the most important things, and we have to deal with them. And so this REPL-oriented way, using fiddle files and this kind of non-linear exploration of these pieces, was just a wonderful way to start to take inventory of the situation, begin to represent that in code, and discover our way toward a combination of information and code, working bits of code, to allow us to discover that solution.
Yeah, we talked about the idea of, you know, running your fingers through the data. And I really like that again and again, and as a way of describing what I have grown used to doing now. Like, we kind of worked our way into that, but it's nothing like actually seeing real data come from real APIs and actually try to download something out of S3 and actually try to, you know, you're like, oh, well, I know I need to get the clip information from the MAM, but what does it actually look like? So you need to, you know, put it in Portal so you can surf through it, because you don't even know what the important parts are until you actually see the real data. So no amount of talking to your boss or talking to the intern or reading documentation is going to get that for you. It's only by actually exploring it, like actually touching the real world, the real situation, that's going to get you that information.
Yeah, and we certainly did not incorporate too many plot points in this series where we began to interact and discovered our approach was a terrible idea and completely pivoted our approach. But that is definitely, in these real world scenarios, I'm looking at a system going, oh, I'm going to go about it this way. And it's that real world interaction that sets me on a totally different path. You know, maybe I'm like, oh, I'm just going to read this data into memory and then I'm going to parse it. And then all of a sudden it's like, oh, I keep running out of memory. Oh, I need a different approach. You know, what am I going to do instead? Right. So pivoting based on what actually happens is another important feature of that.
Yeah, I really like that, you know, where you're actually, you know, pivoting based on information that you got from reality. And so one of the things that really stuck out to me was how we moved from seamlessly from exploration to implementation. As you're going along, it's very nonlinear. You're kind of you start off. We need to get the event data. We need to get the clips. We need to write the files. You know, those. It's very easy. We're gonna spend all of our exploration in those three, you know, stages, and we're never gonna go back. But you realize that as you're exploring, oftentimes you get to the clip information out of the MAM, and you're like, oh wait, what? There's something I needed from the event, so you got to go back to that. And so as you're exploring, you're kind of going back and forth and back and forth between these different parts in your REPL. But then over time, as your knowledge expands, you realize that you're actually starting to implement the actual process that you want. You're implementing the code that actually fetches the files from S3 and the code that actually creates the final highlight reel. And so over time, you go from this random kind of chaotic exploration to, hey, I can actually assemble a whole clip just by working in my REPL. I execute this one up here, this line down here, and then this one at the end. And hey, I can actually do the process. I'm the one orchestrating it, you know, as a developer, but you actually have the workings of the actual solution. And you didn't even, you know, it's not like you did all your exploring and then you're like, all right, now I'm going to put my real big boy pants developer on and go write the real code. You know, you've actually stumbled into the solution, you know, over time.
Yeah. And you were working on these pieces in the REPL. So for each of these systems, and you're putting together little abstractions and little functions and little parts that made sense, you're building up these parts in a very pragmatic way. Like, I need to query the database. Well, let me write the one query I need right now, and later I can write some more queries, and let me pull out the data. And so all these little pieces, they emerge, and they're sort of shrink-wrapped to what you need at the time. and then they start to come together. And Clojure helps facilitate this in a couple ways, because you can just run these pieces in an ad hoc way. If you're using this fiddle file oriented method that, you know, we advocate for, it's very random access in the file. You go run this little part, you go run that little part, and you don't need this, you know, static public void main entry point. Yeah, everything right. has to go through. Or weird hacks where you're running a web server so you can hit all these different endpoints to try to, you know, run different little bits of code or whatever, right? You just run these parts. And then Clojure also helps us because it's dynamically typed. And so you don't have to make everything agree as you're figuring the parts out. So you can just kind of work on each of these parts without having to unify them in some kind of global proof system that's being foisted on you by static analysis.
Yeah, absolutely. There's no foisting at all. It's you're able to move so fast. Like I've said it in the past, I feel like it's like whiplash driven development. Like it's like you're moving so fast, you got to take a break just to take a breath, you know. And you get to the point where you have working code so quickly. You can actually stop there if you want. Like I have some things in my own code that I just have the fiddle file. But it's you know, it definitely is good to keep going if you want to have something a little more automated, of course.
Right. And so that reminds me of a related point then. This bottom-up way of constructing in Clojure has these two properties. You're grounded in the real world, and you're just making what you need as you go along. So it's not very wasteful at all, right? It's very efficient in terms of getting to where you're going. So when you're trying to figure things out, sometimes you can use other tools, like you could use a database tool to just open a database and look at the tables and browse around and so on and so forth, right? Mm-hmm. And other purpose-built tools. But what's neat is as you begin to build these pieces in the REPL, you're getting actual code that you will just kind of, as you said before, find its way. Some of that code is going to find its way into your final working solution, you know? And so you're always making progress. You're always grounded in reality. And you're just building what you need as you go along. So it's not wasteful. It's very iterative, very lean, very forward motion, very the proof is in the pudding, you know, run the code and there it is.
Yeah, absolutely. And the cool thing about it all being in Clojure is that you can cross information streams a lot easier. If you were using separate tools, like, you know, you're using PSQL to explore the database or using the S3 command line to explore S3. So, invariably, you're going to get information in one of those information silos, so to speak, that you want to use in one of the other areas. But if it's all in Clojure code, it's all data you can just hand back and forth. You can just make a def there, you know, just hold on to that data. You can iterate in another comment block. I mean, there's just so much flexibility to have it if it's all in the same process space. And so not as a like dig on those other tools. Some tools are great. And lots of tools are great. But being able, because you can pull all the data into one process space, it really, like you said, it really makes it so that you're just getting the stuff that you need, and then you can trade between different tools really easy, or different, you know, information silos really easily.
Right. And so you're starting to get a feel for what those seams need to be and how they need to be joined together too, right? So you're discovering the properties of each of the systems or information silos you're working with, but then you're discovering the properties of how that data might fit together and merge together. And so it's this grounded, incremental process for each of the parts, but then also as the parts come together.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I think that kind of leads me to kind of the next thing that stuck out is we took that REPL code where, you know, we were running different parts of different functions, different area, different parts of that REPL file, and we moved it into a single top to bottom run the process from the beginning to the end. And it took us a few episodes to get there, but we ended up with this a single representation of the entire process. And it ended up, you know, we had some problems with it later with, you know, having to debug and retry and that kind of stuff. But it was a good place to start to see how everything fit together. Because sometimes you don't really know what the final solution is going to be. Even though we know we had all the necessary parts in our REPL, but we didn't kind of see how what happens when they run, you know, back to back. You know, because I mean, we're like, well, the database will be fine every time. Well, until that one time we ran it and the database wasn't there and our whole thing blew up, you know, until you start running it all as one big unit, as one big orchestrated function, you don't really know how it's going to behave together because it's greater than the sum of its parts.
Yeah. And once it's automated, you can run it more frequently. And so some of these things you only discover when used at great frequency. You just got lucky all the other times you ran it in your REPL. And unless something has some sort of terrible reliability profile with, you know, 50% uptime or something, probability is every time you try to look at it, it's going to be fine. So it isn't until you really start running things over and over and over or more frequently or, you know, quote unquote, at scale, that you begin to discover these smaller percentages of reliability issues. You know, and so it's allows you to, as you put all this together and you automate it, you begin to really discover how this is going to play out more in a production sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, altogether. And so you're still doing some of that learning. You know, early on you were learning the, you know, what the edges of the system were, and now you're learning how the system behaves together. And so you're still able to iterate it in the REPL flow. But you're just iterating with now something that you've created the whole orchestration function instead of the individual parts.
Yeah. And so then speaking of reliability, there's one of the things we really discovered as we were going along in this series is the way you increase reliability is by minimizing things with side effects and maximizing things that are pure, because that really allows you to test those pure things extensively. But then also when we have, as you mentioned, this pure context, it has everything in it, right? Well, we're able to maintain this pure context because of immutability, and we don't have to worry about things monkeying around with it as much, you know, especially in a multi-threaded environment. And so this pure data, these pure functions, it gives us a lot of insight into the information that the application was working with when something went wrong. It gives us the ability to do a lot of testing. And so we just want to make the IO, which in this case is the functions that have to have side effects. There's no way to avoid it, right? The program without IO is just heating up your room by keeping your CPU busy, right?
Absolutely.
And so, yeah, so by minimizing that, we were able to move towards a more and more and more reliable system.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the things that you can kind of iterate and get closer with these small reliability gains. And again, you're still learning, like we said before, you're still learning on every step what the point in that orchestration function needs more reliability. You know, what needs to be tested more, what logic needs to be pulled out, you know.
Yeah. And so then the goal really is to get this pure data for everything in this kind of visible in sort of like the most kind of the furthest down the road sense, right? Consolidated into this one context that has everything. And so that includes pure data to represent the state of the application, right? Pure data for an intent of an operation. So when we were talking about, for example, querying AWS, sort of putting all of the details in one map. So the thing that actually does the query doesn't have to do any thinking, right? It's just like, oh, I just go. Pure data for what came back from that operation. Pure data. Now you can start collecting past history and things. This is all pure data, right? And so generally, the more pure data you have, the more visibility you're going to have, the more pure functions you have, the more testability you're going to have. And so reliability and pureness in this case are definitely related.
Yeah, definitely. And then I really like where we ended up with the, and not so much the code, but the idea of, what was it? Think, do, assimilate.
Yes.
Where we took all of the pure operation. All the pure logic, all the decision making, we moved it into the think and the assimilate, and only the IO was in the do. So all we were doing in that was just basically picking out parameters and passing them to the IO functions. You know, the AWS execute or the next JDBC execute. I guess there's a common commonality to those verbs. But what in reflecting on that solution, like the thing that stuck out to me as I was thinking about this episode and what kind of we came to at the end was, it's amazing how much pure computation and logic there is in this process. Because at the beginning it felt like, I mean, it's all IO. It's all about downloading. It's all about getting stuff out of the database. It's all about assembling things. Like literally everything in this is going to be like 80% IO and like 20% logic. Like it's not going to be hardly any logic. Like what do we even need to extract? But then at the end, you end up with a solution that has like three IO points, you know, execute database query, execute AWS request, execute command line. That's it. And the sum total of that code is like six lines. And then 95% is this pure logic, you know, engine that we made, and it's all testable. And so we went, like, I feel like mentally in my mind, we went from a IO centric mentality to a pure mentality, and all of that, all of the IO is so small, it almost vanishes behind this, you know, thing that can be easily tested and we can know everything about.
It is really amazing how much opportunity there turns out to be to move things into pure functions. Mm-hmm. You think it's IO-centric, there isn't going to be much, as you said. But when you retrieve a result, you have to sift through it to get parts of it. Well, that can be a pure function. When you need to put some things together, like I need to figure out what the file name is going to be for these things. Well, you're taking little bits of data and you're making new bits of data, the file name. Well, that can be a pure function. And so it turns out that the actual fetching of the thing or the querying of the thing ends up constituting a pretty small part of your application. It's the working with the stuff that mm-hmm. tends to dominate, you know, unless all you're really doing is like, I'm making a downloader that just downloads files. Even still, from a lines of code point of view, most of the information is related to working with the stuff. And because you can usually just delegate out the IO operation to a function call that does the read or the write or a few function calls. And so this pattern allows you to maximize your testable surface in your application by factoring all that out.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think we just, and by we, I mean me. I'm not saying like generally other programmers, like I can, it's just really easy to, when you're in a function, in the midst of a function that's going to do IO, I just do a little, oh, let's make the file name. Oh, let's make the request here. Like it's just really easy because it feels like it's so related to the IO to put it next to the IO. But in reality, like, just like you said, that's all pure stuff you can pull some out, put somewhere else.
Yeah.
So it's like a mentality shift.
Yeah, and so in this whole series, this arc, we started very grounded, very incremental, very shrink-wrapped to the specific systems, very emergent, and then we started putting these pieces together, and all of a sudden, this pure stuff started coming out more and more, and these pure operations and pure data, and then it starts coming together, and then the balance starts shifting, where you mm-hmm. start minimizing these IO parts because your domain has emerged, right? And so we've gone through this whole trajectory in the Sportify series, where we've gone from the deep unknown into the very known, very visible, very modeled, very represented, very clear, so that you, your future self, you in 6 months, can come back and look at this and make sense of it.
That's always the trick. Yeah, it's because so much of the computation has moved into pure functions, and so much of the context of the computation and the process is now represented in data. it's glaringly obvious. It's very simple to see what's going on, and you can just like, I mean, you can even like just log out every single context between each operation, and you can see over time how the process is moving through the steps that it needs to. I mean, it might be a lot of data, but you know, that's just a good opportunity for using more closure to make that data comprehensible.
Yes. So we could just keep talking about this on and on and on. I feel like we've learned a lot in this series, discovered a lot in this series. It certainly has been a lot of fun. But why don't we do this instead? Why don't you come talk to us about this series by joining our Clojurian Slack channel, which is the Clojure Design Podcast channel. We hang out there and we have discussions, and we love to hear your takeaways. And so if you pop on over there, you can tell us what was the stuff that jumped out at you in this series. We also respond to things like tweets on that platform now known as x.com. And you can tweet at us at Clojure Design and email. That asynchronous messaging system of the internet that we all love and hate at the same time. You can email us at feedback@closuredesign.club.
Absolutely. Please let us know what you think. Please let us know. One of our listeners, he pointed out that there's someone else had a solution that's very similar to this. So go into the podcast channel and check it out and give us your take on how it compares. Find our show notes and past episodes on the web at closuredesign.club, including this entire series and the notes for this episode.
Yeah, go check out the website. We have a lot of resources there for you. That's going to be it for this Sportify series. Next time we come back, we're going to be starting a new series. So until then, thanks for listening.